We've been introduced to Daniel as well as his three friends. You're guaranteed that just by starting, someone's going to walk in the door. But now that I switched to this spot, I can't tell. So, in the previous parak, we learned about the greatness of Daniel and the story with the food and how he became a vegetarian. This one is going to start us off on the dreams of King Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel attempting to interpret the dreams. It's a bizarre story in terms of Nebuchadnezzar's conduct within it. You kind of wonder how he became king of an empire. And one of the things that we have to figure out is what is the goal of this story? Meaning, nothing is going to change for the Jewish people from the beginning of the parak to the end of the parak. And so what we need to ask ourselves is, why do these events take place? What's the goal? What's the end game? What is behind everything that happens here within the parak? So we begin with a little bit of chronology. But chronology is not always just a date. And that, I hope, will become clear very shortly. Ubishnas shtayim l'malchus Nebuchadnezzar. It is year 2 of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Chalam Nebuchadnezzar chalomot. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Vatitpa'em ruchav. Vatitpa'em is a funny word to translate. I would take it as his breath literally was interrupted, but I'm going to come back to it because it's an important word. Ushnaso nihiyasa alav. And his sleep either was upon him or was broken upon him. And I'm going to come back to that phrase also. But first we need to understand what's going on when we say that it's the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. Because that's a problem. The most basic problem, and we talked about this a little bit last week, is that Daniel and his friends are supposed to be in a 3-year training program. This was to learn for 3 years in order to become members of the court. But they're going to be involved in what happens in this story. So how is this story happening in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar? I talked about this a little bit last week when we asked the question of whether Daniel went through the full 3 years and so on. So a few different approaches. Ralbag takes the count literally. He says, yeah, it's the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, and what that means is, at the end of the first parak, we saw what happens when Daniel completes his training, but now we're going backwards to something that happens during his training. So this is year 2, and yet Daniel is a trainee at this stage, which will fit into a certain element of the story, because what's going to happen in this story, I'll tell you now, is that Nebuchadnezzar is going to have a dream, and he's going to summon all of his advisors to explain it, and when he summons them, Daniel's not going to be there. So that makes sense if he's, you know, currently in training. That's why he's not there. So that's one read. That's Ralbag. Rashi gives a different approach. Rashi says it's his second year, not of monarchy, but the second year since he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's the idea. Now, Rashi is basing himself on a medrash in what's called Seder Olam, which is our key body of medrash for giving us history in general for this period. But if you take a look at source number 1, Rashi explains why he says this. He says, "Bishnas shtayim l'churban habayis," the second year after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, "kach shnuya b'Seder Olam." He says that's the way it's recorded in Seder Olam, the body of medrash I just mentioned. The Karo Lemalchus Nebuchadnezzar, and it's called the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Al Shehera Zidono Likanes Lesoch Devir Malkoshal Olam, because he demonstrated his Zadon, his wickedness, I wrote in hubris in my translation. I think that's an okay translation. In entering the palace of Hashem. So it's his, it's not his reign, it's his entry into the palace of the king. It's been 2 years since he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and Abarbanel supports this idea as well. I brought it for you in number 2 because he also does something which is a hallmark of Abarbanel that's worth knowing about. It's what got Abarbanel kicked out of the Beis Medrash in various yeshivas. So it's a good thing to be aware of. He says in number 2, Amro l'malchus Nebuchadnezzar, when it says the second year of the monarchy of Nebuchadnezzar, Sheyira Soser Lezeh, Kvar Perisei, which appears to contradict this, meaning the previous chronology that we were familiar with, the fact that there had already been 3 years. So he says, Kvar Pershuhu Yafe Mefarshei Hanotzrim. He says, the Christian commentators have explained this well. And that is what sets a lot of people off. Abarbanel, remember who he is. We talked about this in the first week a little bit, but it's worth remembering. Abarbanel is a key member of the court of King Ferdinand, Queen Isabella in Spain. Being a member of their court doesn't just mean that you handle numbers well so you can deal with their finances. You have to be able to converse with them. You have to be familiar with their culture and educated in a way that they're going to respect. And so Abarbanel is very familiar with Christian thought and the way they approach Chumash and the way they approach Tanakh. And he's not afraid to actually say, you know, they got this right. He's also not afraid to say they got this wrong. And generally speaking, if he quotes them, it's to say, and this is just wrong. And he then goes on a tantrum for like two columns explaining why they're wrong. But sometimes he quotes it and says, no, this is actually correct. And in this case, he cites it with approval. And there are Bate Medrash where you won't find a Abarbanel for that reason. Because, you know, it is an odd thing. Like, don't we have enough commentators of our own? You know, why are we, you know, going to theirs? But Abarbanel seems to believe the doctrine of Kabelas Emes Me Amaro or Misha Amaro, of accepting truth wherever you find it, and he's willing to credit them with it. And so he says, the Kvar Pershu Yafa, he says, they explain this well. What is the explanation for the 3 years? The second year, I should say. Ba'amram Shen Nebuchadnezzar Hayirishon Melech Bavel Bilvad. They say that Nebuchadnezzar was originally just king of Babel. Va'ala al Yerushalayim pamayim shalosh. We know he invades Yerushalayim 3 times in the end, or pamim shalosh, perhaps it'd be read. Ve'achrei shechriva, and after he destroyed Yerushalayim, then he conquered other things. Kavash es Mitzrayim, Amon, Moab, Eretz Plishtim, v'chol hachaf alaf amos shezachar Yirmiyahu. U'malach az bekipa. When we talk about Nebuchadnezzar being king over the world, that's something that he goes to after conquering Yerushalayim. So this is sort of the beginning of his greater reign. When he conquers the Beis HaMikdash, and when he conquers Israel, at that point he starts to become a greater king, and that's why this is the second year of his reign. It's the second year of his expanded reign. He had years before that in Babel, but this is going global, so to speak. You follow? That's the approach of Rashi and the approach of Abarbanel.
There's this question, timeline-wise, what's the, like, how long into his monarchy did he destroy the Beis HaMikdash? What's the difference?
So, Nebuchadnezzar destroys the Beis HaMikdash, which one was it? He invades, as Abarbanel said, 3 times. I'm trying to remember if the first one is during his second year as king or his third year as king. I forget right now. We did mention it in the first week, but since that's 3 weeks ago, I'm not responsible to remember that anymore. And it won't be on the final. The second invasion is 11 years after the first, and then the third invasion is actually, I think, 18 years after the first.
So what does it mean that he's invading? He's not successful?
No, he's very successful. He first invades and then sets tribute, where the Jews are going to have to pay him a tariff, a tax. And then the second time he invades is because the king has decided not to pay the tax anymore. Mm-hmm. And so he puts him down and he appoints somebody else in his place. And the third time is when he actually comes in and destroys the Beis HaMikdash, because the Jews are once again thinking rebellion. Yeah, we can't really accept this idea of somebody reigning over us. We have a big problem with it. And, you know, like Bar Kokhba's revolt is also part of that against the Romans. The Romans had a terrible time with us for decades and decades after destroying the Beis HaMikdash, and frankly before destroying the Beis HaMikdash, so much so that they actually blamed it on us. Hadrian blames the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash on the Jews. If the Jews had only just lived in peace as, you know, our vassals, you know, paying us tribute and so on, everything would have been fine. They forced me to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That's his perspective. Which, you know, when you're, you know, a tyrant, I guess you say things like that. So that's, you know, those are two explanations of how this is the second year. Either it's the really the second year, which is, you know, again, hard to say. I should go back to what I said also in the first week, that Daniel is exiled before the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. Daniel is one of the early group that's exiled, the Cheresh and the Masgir. If you remember from Megillas Esther, where they talk about Asher Hagla, right, that whole group, Mordechai goes into Galus and others, that's a group called the Cheresh and Masgir. Those are the leaders of the Jewish community. They were exiled before the Beis HaMikdash is ever destroyed, in an earlier exile. So So one school of thought is it's earlier in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. The other school of thought says it's after he conquers Israel. Ibn Ezra takes another view, and what he says here is very important, in terms of understanding Tanakh in general. In number three, he says, "Va'anachon be'enai." What appears right in my eyes is "Lamalchuso al kol hagoyim." It's the second year after he is king over all of the nations. Shehizkir Yirmiyah, the 21 nations Yirmiyah would mention. Why then? Because az shakat, at that point everything was quiet. V'chashav machshavos al mishkavo ma'iya ba'achris hayamim. And then he started to think about what's happening in the future, what's going to happen with his nation, with his empire, and so on. That's important because I feel a little bad introducing this Ibn Ezra here because it's going to take away some of the mystery of the dream. But that's what his dream is fundamentally about. It's about the future of Babel. What Ibn Ezra is really doing, though, is saying that the date that's presented here is part of the story. It's not just, here's framing for you, second year in, now you know when we are, and now you can follow what's going on. Rather, the way that Ibn Ezra reads it, bless you, is that it's actually a message to you. This is after Nebuchadnezzar is already king over everything, and that's going to affect his mindset and what he's going to dream and what the meaning of the dream is going to be and so on. So keep in mind when you read Tanakh in general as a question, when the pasuk gives you a date, you have to ask yourself why. When he gives you a place, you have to ask yourself why. Is it trying to tell me something of significance? Okay? So he has...
Ezra and Rav Noah are saying the same thing.
So I thought that at first, but now I don't think so. I think Abar Benel is saying second year after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, which then leads to the other conquests, whereas Ibn Ezra is saying after the other conquests, actually, even further along in his reign. Okay. So we're told he has chalomot. Chalomot, plural. Dreams. So Abar Benel offers two explanations. One explanation is that maybe the dream repeated itself during the night. Think of like with Paro, where he has the dreams also, same message, but multiple dreams. Or alternatively, this was one dream, what we see here, but we are going to see another dream in a later chapter. So dreams, because this is the first of a series that we're going to see for him. Okay. Vatit pa'em rucho is also worth taking a moment to point out. I brought you the reference in number four, but I didn't actually bring the psukim on there. I probably should have. But this word has shown up before minus a letter. Vatipa emrucha. Vayhiva boker vatipa emrucha. When Paro dreamed, he woke up, and vatipa emrucha, his breath caught, his breath was interrupted, or as Rashi says there, his breath was knocking, is Rashi's explanation. It's kind of funny. Rashi with Paro says knocking, but here he says hammering.
Well, there's an extra tough.
There's an extra tough. You got it. Exactly right. There's an extra tough. If you take a look at source number five. Is it number five? Hang on. The way the Midrash presents it here, it gives us differences between the... You know, I'm going to hold off on number five because I'm not quite ready for it yet. But Rashi is building on the Midrash and suggesting that Vatipa'em Rucho... with Paro is because he has one level of disturbance. Vatit pa'em rucho with Nebuchadnezzar is because he has a second level of disturbance. What's the difference between the two? Because in the first one, and we talked about this very briefly at the end last time, the first time round, meaning with Paro, what is it that Paro doesn't know that he needs to turn to his advisors for?
The meaning of the dream.
What is it going to be with Nebuchadnezzar? He doesn't even remember the dream. He just knows something is really wrong. So that the double tough is because he has an even stronger problem. He doesn't remember the meaning, and he doesn't remember what the dream itself was. So this is a vatit pa'em rucho, is that he's really frightened. I wonder if you couldn't also associate this vatit pa'em with Shir HaShirim. The pasuk mayafu pe'amayich, which literally translated in Shir HaShirim is "How beautiful are your feet?" So maybe it's like the Rashi says, "Batit Pa'em" is knocking or hammering. It's like feet walking along, and Maybe that's an association. I don't know. Could be. But Paro, Nebuchadnezzar is disturbed by this dream. He's terribly frightened by it. Doesn't remember everything about it. May not even remember the dream itself, as he turns to the advisors and says, I want you to tell me what I dreamed and what it meant. Now, not everybody believes that that's exactly what's going on. Now we can take a look at the Medrash in number 5.
Now, what is in Yeshaya?
Oh, so Yeshaya is the other place where this, where you see a word like this. Holem Pam is the phrase in that pasuk in Yeshaya, which we take to also mean, like a hammering type of a reference. That's what I brought, just because another case in which the word Pam is used to refer to knocking or hammering. So
the Pamon.
You know what? Yeah, I would guess so. Pamon presumably would be from the same. I hadn't thought about it, but you're right. Pamon would be another use. Good. More material for the next time I do that. So, take a look at number 5. Medrash there. Rabbi Yehuda Amar, Kan Chelma Yada Ufisrone Ba'agabe. Rabbi Yehuda says, here, he knows the dream. Here, meaning Para. That's where he's making the comment. Para knows the dream, wants the meaning. Ulahalan, further along, meaning with Nebuchadnezzar, Chelma Upisrone, he wants to know the dream and what it means. Rabbi Nechemiah Amar Chalom Hatzelem V'Chalom Ha'ilan. Rabbi Nechemiah says that's not what Vatit Pa'em means, rather it's because there are two dreams. There's the dream here, and then a dream of a tree, which is later on. V'Rabbanan Amri, and then the sages give another explanation, Vatit pa'em ruchau, lahalan liten gedula la'arba, kan vatit pa'em liten gedula la'echad. They suggest it's because the dream of Paro leads to the elevation of one person, who is
Yosef.
Right. The dream of Nebuchadnezzar will lead to the elevation of four people who are Daniel and his three friends, Naim, Mishael, and Azariah. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Yes.
That would be good.
Yeah. So that's another explanation, which it continues to say it also causes them to live. Yosef getting life versus the four of them getting life. And then one other explanation. Kan al yidei shu samuch lavoker vatit pa'em rucho ulahalan shu bami ba'erev ksiv vatit pa'em rucho. This is a very interesting idea. Paro's dream is near morning. Nebuchadnezzar's dream is in the evening. Where did you invent that from? Where do you get that from?
Well, because it says after that, and then he's asleep.
Well, that's the question. How do I explain the phrase? Exactly. That his sleep was upon him. What exactly does that mean? So Rashi says it means it was broken. The word Nihyasa can mean broken. Mm-hmm. But Barbanel does it as this Medrash does and says that, he actually does the opposite. He says, "Ushniyaso niyasa alav," means his sleep was upon him. It was already at the end of the night. The Medrash is saying his sleep was upon him, meaning he had just fallen asleep. Abarbanel says his sleep was already upon him, and he gives you this biological association. He says, I wrote it in number 6, but to explain it outside of it, he says, science informs us in, 1490 whatever, that the true dreams don't come at the beginning of when you're sleeping. It comes after the vapors from digestion settle in. That's what he says. If it's a true dream, as opposed to if it's just a function of digestion. In other words, dreams in the beginning of the night are just because you're still digesting. At the end of the night, that's a real dream. I didn't look into, the science of dreams in the late 15th century Spain. It just wasn't where I was going. But that's his argument. He says that's how Nebuchadnezzar knows this is a dream to be afraid of. Because it's at the end of the night, that tells him, this is a real message. Okay. All sorts of different ideas that could be presented. The bottom line is, out of all of this, it's the second year of something, either from the beginning of his reign, the first approach, Ralbag, or after his conquest of Israel, Seder Olam Rashi, or after his conquest of the neighbors, Ibn Ezra. And Ibn Ezra's point is most directly related to where this dream is going to go in terms of the fact that it's going to speak to the future of this empire that he has now collected. He is greatly disturbed. Batit Pa'em, even more so than Paro with Batit Pa'em. Side note, remember, we talked about several times already, the parallels between Yosef's story as well as Esther's and Daniel. This is the parallel again with Yosef. With Paro and with Nebuchadnezzar. The shared language is there for a reason. It's there to point you to the similarities between the events. So, let's see what happens. The challenge. Vayomer HaMelech, Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. Vayomer HaMelech, Likrola Hartumim Vela Ashafim Vela Machashafim Vela Kazdim. He says, I want you to summon all of my various counselors. And there are four different groups that are identified here who he wants to summon to interpret this dream. And we're going to talk about who those groups are in a few minutes. But lagid lamelech chalomosav, to tell the king what his dreams were. Not to tell the king what they meant, but what the dream is. Vayavahu vayamdu lifnei hamelech, and they stood before the king. So the general assumption really is that he forgot the dream. Not that he was doing this to test them, but he doesn't remember what it is that has him so scared, that has him so frightened. Which leads to a question. Excuse me. Why? Why does Hashem send him a dream in order for him to forget it? What's the goal? Trying to get him upset. This is not someone you want to get upset. Really not. As you'll see.
Well, he wants the
meal.
Right. Well, he's going to need an explanation anyway.
Yeah, but maybe that was easier and someone else could have done that. Daniel needed his like extra.
Because he's so irate and tyrannical, maybe if you remembered it, he'd contradict and say, no, that's not what it means. Like, he has no choice but to accept their explanation.
Because this way he doesn't have any knowledge of his own. Could be.
But because the explanation is not at all favorable towards him. So if someone would give him that explanation for a dream, he wouldn't accept it. But if someone has to tell him the dream to begin with, he's forced to accept whatever their explanation is.
Interesting. Okay. Quite possible.
Like if someone could come up with your own dream, then you have to trust the explanation. That's the easy part.
Well, I mean, if it's going to resonate with him to that extent, you know, the dream resonates enough that he says, oh yeah, that was what I dreamed. Yes, it has a certain veracity to it where you just accept it. So I definitely hear that. Another approach would simply be is to make Daniel's explanation more impressive. Yeah, you want, if the goal here is, and certainly one of the goals of the story is, to elevate Daniel, so it's a lot more impressive. Yeah, explanations of dreams, you might just get lucky. You had a certain set of facts, you offered an explanation, it made sense to Nebuchadnezzar, good. You told him what the dream was, that's really another class. So that's another possibility. Rav Yaakov Meidan in Israel offers a third approach, which is consistent with something we see in other places in Tanakh. I brought it for you in number 7. He says, Im kol chashivuso shel Nebuchadnezzar kshalito hanigla shel olam, shel ha'olam. He says, with all of Nebuchadnezzar's importance as the visible ruler of the world, hu eino ela shafal anashim, he's the lowest of human beings, as we see in the stories. Sheprala kama regaim shebehem shibeach es Elokei ha'shamayim. He says, other than a few moments where we're going to see him praise Hashem in the fourth parak, aside from that, Avad Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, v'shafach damim kim'at lelo gavul. He's a terrible human being. On every level. Socially, between him and God, everything. Im adam kazeh ein lekut shebrichu dibur yashir. Gam lo derech halamos. God doesn't talk to people like this. He's just not worthy of it. So Hashem's going to send him a dream, but he's not even going to allow him to remember it. We see that elsewhere. At the end of Daniel, we're going to see Daniel have visions and not understand them. And one of the explanations for that is because this is already post-First Temple, post-First Beis HaMikdash, you're not on the level of a Navi like Yeshaya, Yirmiah, somebody like that. Zechariah also, in the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, has vision after vision that requires an angel to explain it to him because you're just not on that level anymore to have that type of
Nebuah.
This is between first and second, yeah. So that's another possible explanation. He's just not worthy of remembering this dream. Hashem has to send him a message. Fine, I'll send him a message. But he's not going to remember what he actually experienced in it. So he calls for the Hartumim. Hartumim are familiar to us already from Mitzrayim, right? We explained them already last week as necromancers, people who speak to the dead, or astrologers is another explanation. I brought you on the sheet Ibn Ezra's approach, as well as Abarbanel's approach, so you can see the different ones, but I'm not going to spend time on it, just because it's a relatively minor detail in terms of what the different roles of these groups were. The approach of Ibn Ezra is to say that the Hartumim understand the flow of events and times and so on. The Ashafim are doctors, he says. The Machashfim are the people who work with special times of day that they say are appropriate to do different things. And the Kazdim are astrologers. Abarbanel offers, as you see here, his own explanations from his Mayuneh Yeshua commentary to the Sefer. The bottom line is that these are all people who Nebuchadnezzar views as people with special insight into the way the universe works, people with special wisdom, and they're going to be the ones who are going to tell him what his dream means. Clear? There are actually more groups that he's going to bring at the end of the parak that we'll have to get to. I should note, Rsaji Gaon is alone in saying that it was actually a test. Rsaji Gaon is the only one among the classic commentators to the Sefer who say he was actually testing them. Everybody else believes he does not remember the dream. So let's see what happens. He calls them, he summons them in front of the king. Daniel is not in the group. Vayomer lahem hamelech. And the king says to them in Pasuk Gimel, Chalom chalamti. Who used the phrase Chalom chalamti? Paro. Right, that's true. We borrow it from there also. Chalom chalamti is another phrase of Paro. Chalom chalamti upoter ein oto vani, etc. Yes. So he says, I have dreamed a dream. Vati pa'em ruchi, and he says, my spirit was interrupted or knocking or whatever, however you want to translate this word. Lada says hachalom, to know the dream. I want to know the dream, yeah.
No, here it's only one tet.
Here it only says one dream. Oh, one taf in Vati Poem. Right, that's also true. He drops the other one. Maybe he's a little bit embarrassed to say just how frightened he is, right? So, Vaydabro hasdim la melech aramit. These Chaldeans, these Kazdim, the last of the groups, speak to the king in Aramaic. And they say to him, Malka la'almin chayi, O king, you should live forever. Emarcha mala'avdach, tell your servants what you dreamed, ufishra nechabei, and we will tell you what it means. We'll give you the explanation. Fair offer, right? I mean, that's sort of the normal job description. Why they switch to Aramaic? Well, I talked a bit in the first week. We were talking about why the book switches into Aramaic, but why did the child? And it is going to from here on for the first half of the book is now going to be Aramaic. But aside from why the book switches to Aramaic, why did the Kazdim switch?
They say it like they say, and now they switch over. Like it's not like they just start talking.
Right. It says by the book Kazdim Lamelech Aramit. See, if it hadn't stressed that they switched to Aramaic, I would have just assumed exactly what you're saying, which I think Ibn Ezra says also, which is because that was their native tongue. They're Chaldeans. So there are different tongues that are being used, a higher and a lower, but it's possible that they were speaking Aramaic and the book is stressing it. In other words, it could be Sefer Daniel starts out in Hebrew, gives us a parak plus in Hebrew because that's the language that we use. But here it wants to show you what they're doing with Aramaic, and then we get the rest in Aramaic because of either, as we explained in the first week, either because that was the language of the time that was being used, or we give a few different explanations. But the Abarbanel says you have to follow what they're trying to accomplish here. Take a look at number 10. Shakazdim chashvu shamela chalam chalom mavhil mafchid me'od. Right? They thought the king is very afraid. Morel kotzer yamav. So this must have to do with him living only a short time, right? He has some kind of dream that he's going to die. Oh, alternatively, al inyan hashpala so, or maybe his removal from power, o chedomet. V'lachein lo hayarotze legaloso b'fnei hachamim. So he doesn't want all of these other advisors
to know. Right? Thinking like Khartoumim are Egyptian, possibly, as they were, you know, in Paro's day. Mitzvim, Plishtim, Amonim, Moabim, Yeser, Alashanos, all these other people. And so they figure, we'll talk to him in our language, and he'll tell us what the dream was. He didn't want to say in front of the others, but, you know, Lanzmann, we're close. Let him tell us what this is, and we'll explain it. So they switch into Aramaic from whatever language it was, or just stressing that they spoke to him in Aramaic, which the other advisors didn't speak.
But is there any proof that the other advisors were from other countries?
None. Except that we know that they took Daniel and his group and said, now we want Hebrews to be in our palace also, so this wasn't the unique practice. He did it with others.
He did this with every nation he conquered. He did their best.
But the weakness of it, I think, is that with Daniel and crew, he said they have to be trained in our language. So presumably the others also would speak it. So that's a weakness in what Barbanel is suggesting. I like it from a plot perspective. But I don't think that it really holds water in terms of the fact that they all would have learned Aramaic, just like Daniel and his group learned Aramaic. So I have a hard time with his comment from that perspective. Okay. So they say, tell us the dream, and we're friends, we'll help you. So that doesn't work so well. Ani Malka, in Pasuk Hey, the king responds, Ba'amar l'kazdoi, and he declares to these kazdoi, Milsa mini azda, the phrase has gone forth from me. The word has already gone out. Hein lo sehod unani chelma ufishrei, if you do not tell me the dream and its meaning, hadamin tis avdun, you will be cut into small pieces. Uvatecha nevala yitzamun, and your houses will be laid waste, will be made into ruins. That's it. I mean, this is the barbaric Nebuchadnezzar. This is the destroyer of the Beis HaMikdash, conqueror of the Jewish people, conqueror of many lands after that. Just a all around horrible specimen of a human being. That's who we're talking about. And that's his threat to them. Why so harsh? Is it just really just he's a brutal person? Or maybe there's something else here.
Feeling
crying, right, it's a reaction to stress, for sure. Sorry, bad day, you know. Didn't get a good night's sleep the night before. So Barbanel throws you a thought which I think is worth thinking about. Take a look at number 11 on the sheets. All along he's been supporting these people, right, giving them all, as he did with Daniel and his group, from the king's table. He thought they really knew what they were talking about. And they used to say, oh, we're so great, we can read people's minds. Not only can we answer their questions, we know what the question is before they even ask. Right? We are the great advisors to King Nebuchadnezzar. Even if the guy doesn't tell us, we know. So now, he says...
But if he doesn't know, how does he know that they're not saying the truth?
They're supposed to be... I'm just the king. They're the advisors. They're supposed to know everything.
Right, but if he doesn't know his own dream, they can make up the dream and say, that was your dream. He can't say, oh, it wasn't. He doesn't know.
Nobody can remember. That's a bit...
There has to be something that will resonate.
Right.
Yeah. Or maybe they believe it's a test. Maybe they follow Rav Sanjago. They think that he's actually testing them.
Right.
And so they're saying, come on, this isn't funny anymore, King. You know, tell us the dream. And then we'll work this out. So that's what Barbanel says. He says, this is put up or shut up time, guys. Like, you've been eating off of my table for however many years, claiming that you know everything. Now I need your help. And if not, then what have you been doing, you know, in my palace, at my table? So, you know, maybe that's cause for his harshness. Well, they're out of luck. Note, by the way, I said this to you originally when we talked about the switch to Aramaic. The Aramaic is very similar to Hebrew. You can pick up a lot just, you know, from Hebrew knowledge on this. Some of the words are a little harder, but in general, you can see what's going on.
He'll throw in Hebrew.
Okay. Vehein chelma ufishrei t'hachavon. And some of it sounds like pirshmei. So you have that from davening. Vehein chelma ufishrei t'hachavon. He says, you're going to tell me the dream and its meaning. Matnan Univisba, it's hard to pronounce though. Vikar Sagit Kablumin Kadamai. He says, if you tell me the dream and its meaning, I'm going to give you presents, I'm going to give you spoils, you're going to have great wealth. I'm going to reward you for telling me this dream. This, don't think there's no percentage in doing that. Lahain chama ufishrei hachavoni. Therefore, lahain is like lahain. Therefore, tell me the dream and tell me what it means. Ano sinyanus v'amrin. They responded a second time and they said, Malka, O king, chelma yemar la'abdo. Let the king tell everybody what the dream is. Ufishrei hachavei, and then we'll tell you what it means. Once again. Ani Malka v'amar. So the king says, Min yatsiv yada ana di'idana antun zavnin. He says, you know, I'm not a fool. I know what you're doing. What you're doing is, you are buying time. And that's literally the expression. If you look at the phrase, idana antun zavnin, what is zavnin? You know this word. Yes, you do. Chagadja. Dizabinaba, right? It's to buy. Idana is time. If you say Rishme when they take out the Torah, b'chol idan v'idan, idan is time. Antun is you, right? The nun gets thrown in, but other than that, you can recognize it from the Hebrew. The word anashim, right? Ish becomes anashim in the plural. The nun really belongs in the root, belongs in the shoresh. So you see it in the Aramaic where it's ant. So Idana Antun Zavnin, you are buying time. If you want to know where the expression comes from, it's Daniel. So you can feel good about that, because that means you're learning Torah when you use the expression. So the king says, you're stalling. When you keep telling me, oh, tell us what the dream is, tell us what the dream is, I know what's going on. Kol kavel v'chazesun di azda mini malka, milsa, because you see that the word has gone forth from me, and you know you're in trouble, so you're stalling. Dihein chelma lo sahau de unani. So he says, if you're not going to tell me the dream, chadahi das chon. One thing is going to happen to you. What is it? We know already. The one thing is the punishment. Umila chidva ushchisa hizmintun lememar kadamai. And he says, if you're going to try to tell me something false, you're going to try to tell me something not true. Adi idana yishtane, until time changes, you think you're stalling, and eventually my mood will change. He says, lahein chelma amaruli. Therefore, just tell me the dream. Ve'inda di fishreit hachlunani, and then I will know that you're telling me the right explanation. I'm going to know whether what you're telling me is true or not. That's what he says to them. Notice again a phrase that appears elsewhere in one of the parallel stories in Tanakh. Chadahi das chon is the same as in Megillas Esther, achas daso lehamis. Right? When Esther says to Mordechai that whoever comes before the king without being called to the king, achas daso lehamis. He has one rule for all, he will kill them. So it's the same phrase, achas daso, and here in the Aramaic, chadahi das chon. You will have one law for all of you. You all know you're facing the death penalty, and therefore you're stalling. And I've had enough of this stalling. So pasuk yud, ano chazdoi kadamalka. They respond to the king. Va'amrin, and they said, la isai enesh al yabeshta di milas malka yuchal ha'chavaya. There isn't a person on earth who can tell you what this means. And that's again another popular phrase that you can chalk up to Daniel. La'isai enash al yabeshta, literally, there isn't a person on earth. Yabeshta yabeshet. So, yeah, we're just quoting Daniel left and right. No one can tell the king what he dreamed. Kol kavel di kol melech rav v'shalit mila chidna la'she'el. And no king anywhere would ask such a thing. To any sorcerer, wizard, advisor, whatever, no one has ever asked such a thing. Human beings don't do this. Umilsa di malka she'el yakira va'achron ala isai v'chavina kadam malka. What you're asking is a very heavy thing, a very difficult thing, and no one could possibly answer you. Lahain elakin di medarhon im bisra la isohi. Only the gods, I suppose it should be Allahin because they're referring to their gods. But only the gods could tell you this. Human beings are not capable of this. So you know that Nebuchadnezzar is not terribly interested in their excuses.
Right? Seems very gutsy of them to keep answering him back. Keeps threatening them, they keep going, but we don't know. Like, why don't they just make something up?
Well, that's almost even more gutsy. He doesn't resonate with
him. And if it was their past.
Right. I think. Right. I have to think that if they say something and he calls them on it and says, no, that's false, I think they lose their heads now.
And this way, it seems that he's going to crush their heads regardless.
Right, but now they're trying to bargain and trying to stall for time.
I'm saying that no king would ask such a thing. That's like,
it's a little tough to have
that.
Yeah.
But they are like their
only hope, you know. Like, they're saying to him, like, I mean, really? I mean, we never expected anybody to ask us something like this. Like, this, you know, it's an unthinkable challenge that you're putting in front of us. So, things don't look good for them. Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. I noted even Ezra on the sheet from in number 11, just they're referring to Malachim, because Malachim are beings of truth, and therefore, that's who we'll know. But Pasuk Yud Bet, Kol Kavel Dina Malka Binas Uktsaf Sagi. Well, Kol Kavel Dina is a phrase that is worth knowing if you're reading Daniel, because it comes up a lot. It means basically at this point, after all this had happened. So at this point, the king gets very angry. Va'amar lahavad lachol hakimei Bavel. Out of time, he says, destroy all of the sages of Bavel. Get rid of all of them. V'dasa nefgas, and the word went forth, v'chakimayim iskatlin, and they were killing the scholars, the sages. Uba'o Daniel v'chavroi lihiskatala, and they were going to kill Daniel and his friends as well, even though they weren't in the court, as becomes clear in the next pasuk. They're not in the court, but the decree is not just kill my advisors, all the Chachamim of Bavel.
Like, nothing smart.
Yes, there will be no smart people in my kingdom. he doesn't really think things through. But he wants them all dead. That's correct. And they're starting. Like, it's not just like hypothetical. This is underway, and they're now summoning Daniel, like, you know, to the guillotine. They're gonna kill Daniel. Beidayin, at that point. Daniel hasiv eita uteim. Daniel responded with eita, which is like eitza in Hebrew, with counsel and wisdom. La aryoch rav tabachaya di malka. To aryoch rav tabachaya. What is a rav tabachaya?
The head executioner.
Chief executioner, right? Like in Egypt again, the rav tabachim. Mm-hmm. Literally, a tabach is a chef or a butcher, and well, that's sure. What it is. So he tells aryoch. And then Rashi here comments that it's the executioner, and it makes sense. So Daniel says to the Aryoch, this executioner, "Dinefak lekatala lachakimei Bavel, who had gone out to kill the sages of Bavel, aneva amar la Aryoch." He says to Aryoch, "Shalita di Malka, who was the person in charge for the king." He says, why did the king issue such a hasty decree to kill people? This mahatzafa is from the same source as chutzpah, same word. So he says, why this hasty decree from before the king? And at that point, Aryoch explains what's going on. So Daniel doesn't know. This, again, supports the idea that the second year is during Daniel's training, and that's why they weren't yet in the king's court. So Daniel says, what's going on? They tell him the story. V'Daniel al uva'am in Malka, diziman yintin lei, ufishra l'achavaya l'malka. So Daniel requests from the king, give me some time and I'll tell the king the meaning of his dream. Now, we know of nothing in Daniel's record, history, or anything prior to this moment in time that said that he had any ability to do this whatsoever. But he says, give me a little bit of time, and then I will tell you what it was that you dreamed. He's going to put himself on the line. Clear? Okay. So what's he going to do? Beidayin, at this point, no, I'm sorry, I jumped backwards. Edayin, at this point, Daniel levese azal, Daniel goes home. And he informs his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he tells them, we have to daven. We have to pray to Hashem for this secret. That we shouldn't be destroyed along with all of the sages of Babel. And lo and behold, Daniel gets the night, apparently, to do this. And at night, he has a dream, and it is revealed to him. And Daniel blesses Hashem. He thanks Hashem for having saved him. And what does he say to thank Hashem? Ane Daniel ba'amar. Daniel declares, the word ane, I keep translating it as answer, but it's not always answer. The word la'anot, we think of as answer, but in Tanakh it's often to declare. You see it in Zechariah a lot. That it's to declare. In Eov also it's to declare. Here too. So Daniel declares and says, a familiar phrase, Laheve shmei dialaka mevarach min olma ve'ad olma, di chachmasa ugvurta dilehi. What did he just say? Laheve shmei dialaka mevarach min olma ve'ad olma. Sound familiar? Yeah, but what's the phrase? Yehei shmei mevarach le'olam lo'me olmai. That's exactly what he said. This is where it comes from. The line in Kaddish comes from Daniel. So we have three phrases now from Daniel, just in 1 hour alone, right? We had buying time, no one on earth, and Yehei Shmei Rabba. So that's his bracha to Hashem, because Hashem has given him the answer. I'm just not sure, because I don't know what time we started. I don't know how much time we have. So I don't know if we're good still. Okay. So we'll see at least Daniel's thanks to Hashem, but then we have to wait until next week to find out what it was that he's actually found out.
And it's sort of interesting that he thanks Hashem first instead of like telling us what the dream, like the sequence of it.
Well, he has this dream during the night,
right?
He wakes up
in the morning before he even tells him to come next, or he's already
doing it. Maybe,
yeah. Maybe
this is
like
they're
like
just the next
sentence.
That's such a bizarre dream.
He
knows Hashem gave it to him. What else?
Would
it
be? Right, once you hear what the dream is and the explanation, you'll realize why it resonates with Daniel. But I will say you're right in the sense that this is a really gutsy thing to tell Nebuchadnezzar. What he's going to tell, for anyone who looked ahead or knows the story, he's going to tell Nebuchadnezzar about the ultimate downfall of the Babylonian Empire. So this is the same like Nebuchadnezzar who has just threatened to cut people into small pieces and destroy their houses because they didn't tell him what his dream was.
Right, so he can get killed anyways.
Well, I guess he better go off davening now then.
Right.
You may not get a chance later. I think what it really speaks to is despite our question about is Daniel a Navi or not.
I was just going to say, this reminds me, how could it be controversial that he's a Navi? If he receives this sort of,
To which the answer I would give is one of the explanations we gave for why he's not a Navi is that the definition of Nebuah is that you have a message to bring to the masses, which he doesn't have. So it's not that his vision is any lesser, but he doesn't have that role, the communal role. Well, so the masses, do we have a Navi who only has Nebuah to an individual?
And it would affect the masses, like, because he's the ruler of...
It will affect the masses. So, and the other answer could be that it's just a lower level.
Yeah.
They
don't
believe they are.
Masses.
Interesting.
So it's
interesting.
Don't we hear, like, people... Even...
Aisara's on the list, but her Nebuah is just Avraham.
Right, so it's the same.
So you're right. So maybe not. Maybe Nebuah can only be to one person. So in that case, why isn't he on the list of Nevi'im? Go back to square one. Unless the answer is it's a lower level. Hashem uses the term dream for the Nebuah, Miriam, and Aharon also.
Even like, you know, 100, 200 years ago having dreams, like somebody comes to them in a dream, like it's not necessarily, they're not called Nevi'im if they have a dream.
But a lot of Nevi'im, they get a dream.
I mean, the question fundamentally is level. You know, at what stage do you say this leaves the level of Ruach HaKodesh and becomes prophecy? And you can't really answer that question. Meaning there's no way.
Is there a controversy amongst the list of 48, or that's like universally accepted in the Gemara?
The Gemara doesn't have controversy about it. The Gemara says there are many more. There are more than on the 48. The 48 are sure on, and then there are
more.
Right. No, the argument that he's not, I gave him the first week, was that the Gemara itself says he's a Chacham and not a Navi. The Gemara itself says he's not a Navi. So, yeah, that's why we leave him out. Plus, his book ends up in Ketuvim and not in Nevi'im. My answer would simply be that Ruach HaKodesh must also come with some level of understanding that this is Ruach HaKodesh. I mean, the Rambam writes about levels of divine inspiration, levels of Ruach HaKodesh. We're going to see that actually in the Shoftim Shir today, the piece on that. The
Right, I just heard about that.
Right, sorry. So, there, the pasuk says in the third parak in Shoftim, but he alav ruach Hashem, regarding the shofet, the spirit of Hashem is upon him. So Rambam writes in Moreh Nevuchim that means ruach hakodesh, and that ruach hakodesh may be something you're aware of, and maybe something you're not aware of at all. It doesn't have to be an intellectual experience. Bless you. So that it could be though that Daniel receives this message, knows it's true. On whatever level he knows that it's true, on whatever level Nebuchadnezzar is going to recognize that it's true. And therefore he wakes up, he says, wow, thank you, Hashem. In general, it's important to realize, we learn about tefillah from Daniel. This is not the only instance of it. The earliest example we have of somebody davening three times a day is Daniel. It's going to get him into trouble, actually. Because everything he does in this book gets him into trouble, and then Hashem bails him out. But Daniel is the very first. We know, you know, Abraham gets up in the morning, and Yaakov davens at night, and you know, Yitzchak goes out l'suach basadeh. But we don't have any of them doing all three. With Daniel, it's going to explicitly say that this is what he used to do, and that he had always done this, which is how we know that the practice of davening three times a day goes back to the first Beis Hamikdash, because it's not described as like unique. This is what you do. So,
and that's instead of the Karbana.
So that's the setting up Shmona Esrei. So, yeah, in other words, as the Rambam writes in the beginning of the Hafaz Tefillah, davening is a mitzvah of some kind, whether it's Daraisa or Darabanan, when to do it and so forth is a debate, Rambam. But he says the text that you daven and the time of day that you daven is not a Daraisa. There's no biblical mitzvah of do it then, but we had karbanos in the morning and the afternoon, and then parts of the karbanos were put on the mizbeach at night, and parallel to that, the chachamim said, okay, so we're going to make you a Shmona Esrei in the morning, Shmona Esrei in the afternoon, and then this added one for Maariv at night. But we learn a lot about davening, and phrases like Yehi Shmei Rava from Daniel. The best stuff in Tanakh is the stuff nobody learns. Okay, so we'll pick up with that, God willing, next week. We'll have to find out what exactly this is.